You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Thursday, December 21st, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Travis Dixon, Professor of Communications at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. On his most recent report, A Dangerous Distortion of Our Families. Also on the program today, corporate America engages in cosplay, dressing up as Kris Kringle in the wake of the tax deal. Also on the program, DOJ calls for booster seats for deportation hearings.
Yep.
We'll know tomorrow whether there's a government shutdown, and hopefully soon read DACA, as Democrats seem to have lost their spine in holding the government to account. Puerto Rico governor vows to seek revenge in the midterm elections. UN members threatened by Nikki Haley over the U.S. Jerusalem move. And the Virginia Assembly control will come down to literally picking out of a hat. U.S. life expectancy drops because of increased and continued opioid overdose deaths. And today is going to be, according to astrologers, the worst day of 2017. Save the worst for the last. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. First, before we go any further, we have a little bit of house cleaning to do here at the show. It is towards the end of the year. And therefore, Michael, do you have something to say to me?
I just wanted to say that I think I've never heard an interview with David Dane that's gone better than the one you did. Mm-hmm. I think that, Tom Hartman does, they're good, but you're just much, much, much better. And a lot of people had tried to do those interviews. A lot of people had tried to do those interviews, but not as good as the interviews you had done. And I think many people had said that your appearance on the media with Bob Garfield, people were... They're usually nervous. You weren't nervous. Mm-hmm. You did it perfectly. Mm-hmm. It was a great job. And we just sort of, we learn from you every day. And I know I learned from you.
Okay, that's only coming every 13 seconds.
And I just admire your leadership so much. And I think that also, I would hope that it just is the best talk I've ever heard. And frankly, everyone's saying it.
I would just add, you said you were going to do that and you did it. And we admire you more for it.
You had said, because you had said that everything, the way that happened with Mike Cernovich, you had said that that would happen before it happened. And it happened exactly as you called it.
That's
it's
true.
Like you're scripting. It's like literally there's a board that you have in your mind that only you see because of your leadership capacities. We can't see it. We can only follow your lead.
That's true.
We're barnacles on your ship. And you're just, we all just are better people because of it. So
that's
I just want to thank you.
You're welcome.
I just want to say I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And you're
Jamie,
better.
Do you want to lead us in a Wiccan prayer?
Oh, it would be my honor. The longest night has come once more. The sun has set and darkness fallen.
Right.
The trees are bare, the earth asleep, and the skies are cold and black. Yet tonight we rejoice in this longest night, embracing the darkness that enfolds us. We welcome the night and all that it holds, As the light of the stars shine down, blessed be, praise Sam Cedar.
I was going to say, I didn't hear my name in it.
No,
earlier,
blessed
okay.
be, blessed be, Sam Cedar. Okay. Blessed be.
The one right. that matters is me. I'm the only one that matters.
Yes, folks. Needed to get that out of the way. I didn't want 2017 to go by without me receiving my praise. Praise be me. This is
like but one thing that I would like.
I gotta say, I actually do feel a little better than I did at the beginning of the show.
I noted those things. Your body posture has improved dramatically.
It's true.
And if we're
holy crap, my sciatica is gone.
Yeah, your sciatica is totally psychosomatic. Obviously, the praise is not going to continue.
Right,
but can we have maybe? I would.
Well,
like
I'm just going to replay that every day. That's all. That's our new opening.
That's a new opening package. At least put in the days I host, I would like a working prayer before the
show
starts.
Well, let's not get carried away.
I want more of that.
I think we've done
Bless
enough.
Bless you, Matt.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have put on a little performance. But nevertheless, as talented as the Majority Report players are in putting on such a performance, it doesn't come anywhere close to how absolutely bat crap insane this was. At the Trump cabinet meeting at the White House, the voice you will hear is that of Mike Pence. The camera has been set up right behind Mike Pence. And all you do is see the arms are crossed in such a very, first of all, it's a very strange pose for anybody to have, period. But it's as if Donald Trump is literally hugging himself and just sort of like can't contain himself and needs to keep it in. He's so ecstatic, like a little boy. And here is Mike. Mike, it's your turn now. You get to say good things about me.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. Mike, would you like to say a few words?
Well, I appreciate it, Mr. President. As I told you last night, shortly after the Senate vote. I know I speak on behalf of the entire cabinet and of millions of Americans when I say congratulations and thank you. Thank you for seeing through the course of this year an agenda that truly is restoring this country. You described it very well, Mr. President. From the outset of this administration, we've been rebuilding our military, putting the safety and security of the American people first. You've restored American credibility on Definitely. The world stage. We're standing with our allies. We're standing up to our enemies. But you promised economic renewal at home. You said we could make this economy great again. And you promised to roll back regulations. And you signed more bills rolling back federal red tape than any president in American history. You've unleashed American energy. You've spurred an optimism in this country that's setting records.
Records.
But you promised the American people in that campaign a year ago that you would deliver historic tax cuts. And it would be a middle-class miracle. And in just a short period of time, that promise will be fulfilled. And I'm deeply humbled as your vice president to be able to be here. Because of your leadership, Mr. President, and because of the strong support of leadership in the Congress of the United States, you're delivering on that middle-class miracle. You've actually got the Congress to do, as you said, what they couldn't do with Anwar for 40 years. You've got the Congress to do with tax cuts for working families and American businesses what they haven't been able to do for 31 years. And you got Congress to do what they couldn't do for 7 years in repealing the individual mandate in Obamacare. I know you would have me also acknowledge people around this table, Mr. President. I want to thank the leaders in Congress.
Not so much.
Yeah. In a certain sense.
Mike, now you can get under the table. And we'll all wait.
Remember,
till you're
Mike,
done.
If it's the president, it's not gay. I like how Tillerson's face is like, he's still an idiot. Still a fucking idiot.
Honestly, I mean, I don't want to diminish how insane this is by joking about it. It is so insane what we're watching and so dangerous. This is the type of stuff that, honestly, if we saw this same video clip and there was some type of if it was, we're hearing Chinese, or we heard, like, you know, some Azerbaijani language, and we would just be sitting here and we could see it printed out. We would laugh and laugh. But this is real. This is, like, happening here.
Those are the only places in the world. I think North Korea, maybe some of the Stans. Like, even Assad's propaganda, from what I've seen, tries to be a little bit more bureaucratic.
Yes, and here's the thing. Like, there's a quality of this that, like, you know, obviously Trump is doing this, you know, I guess Mao did this too, just to F with people. Like, you're going to show your fealty to me. You're going to show your weakness publicly, that you are bowing down to me, right? That's the whole reason why people get on their knees and put their, you know, and allow the king to kiss the ring. But this is a combination of both demanding that type of fealty to show his own power, and also, I think, desperately needing it. Like, Mike, I'm publicly humiliating you too, but if it makes you feel better, I really do need this. It really does make me feel better.
It's the worst of all worlds. Yes. I'm both a sadistic sociopath, and I'm also desperately insecure and needy. And so I just really, so with one hand, I would like to completely take away any shred of dignity, sense of self you have, just for my own pleasure. And then on the other hand, I'd also just like to thank you.
Right.
Because I'm a really hollow person inside.
Know that you're a worthless piece of drib, of garbage, but also that you helped somebody.
What's the context for that clip? Like, did he call a press conference just to make him do that?
Cabinet meeting. And it doesn't end there, of course, because, look, it's one thing, and we just played that clip of Mike Pence literally praising Donald Trump in the most shameless ways that is
disturbing
in so many different ways. The Trump's posture, the look on everyone around Trump of Mattis and Tillerson and what's his face. Wow. Not Cone, but the other guy, the Commerce Secretary.
Wilbur Ross.
And the look. And these are all, you know, they're I think, to their core, they're not good people. But they're also sane human beings. And so they know what's going on here. And the fact that they're not good people is why they're allowing it to progress. And this is what's so dangerous about this type of stuff. That's
Tillerson's
the first
like texting his friends at Exxon at the table, like, what I'm doing to get us tax.
Exactly.
I'm going to say, shout out to Mother for putting that man back together again at the end of every day.
Right.
That cannot be easy.
And here is, of course, when you have something like some type of praise like this, you need to consecrate it by putting God's imprimatur on it. And who better to do that than, of course, Ben Carson?
Because you need the prayer more than I do, I think. You may be the only ones. Maybe a good, solid prayer, and they'll be honest, Ben. Is that possible? So, Ben, we'll ask you to say grace. Okay. Thank you.
Our kind Father in heaven, we're so thankful for the opportunities and the freedom that you've granted us in this country. We thank you for a president and for cabinet members who are courageous, who are willing to face the winds of controversy in order to provide a better future for those who come behind us. We're thankful for the unity in Congress that has presented an opportunity for our economy to expand, so that we can fight the corrosive debt that has been destroying our future. And we hope that unity will spread even beyond party lines, so that people recognize that we have a nation that is worth saving, and recognize that nations divided against themselves cannot stand. In this time of discord, distrust, and dishonesty, we ask that you would give us a spirit of gratitude, compassion, and common sense, and give us the wisdom to be able to guide this great nation in the future. We ask in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen. Oh, that's nice.
Where did Omarosa go?
I wonder if Jared and Ivanka enjoyed that, the Holy Spirit. Here's the thing. if God was actually listening to that, and I think you can tell that God wasn't because the White House was not struck by lightning. But if God was listening, he would say, Ben, the debt's going to get $1 trillion greater at a minimum over the next 10 years. And it wasn't so much unity as it was a majority. Wow. You just had a very slight majority in both houses.
So I'm going to take that, God, and I'm going to interpret it as God sanctified me with holy light and co-signed on everything I said. And that's going to be in my post-presidential, post-White House memoir.
This, I mean,
suck it, God.
In the middle
I'm
of this,
powerful than
didn't
you
feel like, honestly, though, in the middle of that speech, like, I'm just looking around this room, just sort of like this sense of like, is someone pouring gas into this room? Like, is everybody getting lightheaded? Like, it's just so insane to me that it's come down to that we're watching this shit on TV and it's now become like some type of surreal.
The veneer's off.
Some surreal notion of like, you know, like what is that show, the Shattered Glass? The Black Mirror.
Yeah,
I mean, honestly.
It's Black Mirror. It's also a Yeats. I always think of like The Worst of Us. What is it? Like The Worst of Us are filled with passion and fury. Like, I mean, yeah, there's no more veneer.
Oh my God.
It is what it is.
The center cannot hold.
The center cannot hold. Well, that's what we've
apparently
been saying.
Not.
What
thanks,
I've been saying.
Guys. Yeah.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to change
gears. I'm sure RussiaGate will take care of all of it.
Yes.
Thanks, guys.
Well, I don't know that. I don't know what is going to. We're going to take a break. We're going to change gears a little bit. We're going to talk to Dr. Travis Dixon about a report that he was the commissioned by Color of Change. Regarding the dangerous distortion of African Americans in our media.
How about color of my bank account?
I don't think that's in it.
Cash money.
We'll be right back. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Dr. Travis Dixon. He is a professor of communication at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the author of a new report, A Dangerous Distortion of Our Families, Representations of Families by Race in News and Opinion Media, commissioned by Color of Change and Family Story. Welcome to the program, Professor.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start with the scope of the report. I mean, give us a sense of what you surveyed here, and then we'll get into what exactly you were looking for and what you found.
Sure. Thank you. Thanks again for having me. One of the things we wanted to do was to understand how families are represented in the mass media. And mass media and news and opinion media, I should say, as broadly as possible. And one of the ways in which we did this was by trying to examine the national networks, ABC News, CBS News, NBC, and then also the cable news networks such as MSNBC, Fox News, and CNN, and also kind of national newspapers and blogs and websites such as the New York Times, Washington Post, right? And then we wanted to expand beyond that. So one of the things that we did was we looked at some of the larger local outlets, and we kind of divided up the country by regions, four regions, and we kind of sampled newspapers and news blogs from the largest four regions of the United States and essentially kind of expanded from there. Then we also thought about how our news environment has changed over the last couple of years, and people are now looking at ideological websites, including right-leaning websites, Christian websites, and so we also included Breitbart and Christian Today in our sample as well, so sites like that. So that's kind of how broad we went. We looked at, from 2015 to 2016, about 2 years, and we gathered about over 800 stories for this, which is fairly large for content analysis. The average content analysis is probably somewhere between 300 and 500 news items or items to be analyzed, and we kind of doubled that to try to understand what was going on and to try to also understand a little bit about how different news agencies were treating the subject matter. And we were interested when we began looking at families too. So I described a sample. We also decided to examine families, which is something that had not received quite as much attention in the literature. People have been talking about race and media depictions for quite some time in the mass media, and I've contributed somewhat to that literature over the years. But no one has kind of looked at it from the standpoint of how are family units being described and are there differences in race here. And so we began to ask that question with regards to stereotypical depictions and possibly counter-stereotypical depictions as well.
Is there, I mean, it's fairly self-evident, I guess, but I'm curious if there was, I mean, aside from the absence in the literature of a focus on the family unit and how it's portrayed, was there another reason behind why to look at that, or was it simply it rounds out a broader picture that we may have of how race is portrayed in the media?
Right, and so keeping in mind that the story or the study itself was commissioned by Family Story and by Color Change, and they've both been interested in these issues for some time, particularly Family Story, looking at family dynamics and race. You know, that became kind of the main question. How is news and opinion media treating this question? And one example of where we've thought about this before, but now thinking about it in the context of families gives us some sort of relevance. There are two places where I think that's really useful to kind of consider. One is with regards to welfare and poverty, where we know in the past there's literature that suggests that African Americans are closely associated or overly represented, I should say, as being part of the poor as well as welfare recipients. And political scientists have been able to document this, and other communication scholars have documented this. And what we're finding is when we discuss African American families, the issues of poverty and welfare come up quite a bit. And again, when we look at welfare recipients in the context of families and those who are living below the poverty line in the context of families, African Americans tend to be overrepresented in those roles. Similarly, with regards to crime in news, I've done work and others have done work, Color Change has done work on this, where we found that African Americans are often overrepresented as criminal suspects when you compare their representation in the media to crime reports. Right, and we found this in different regions. I've spent a lot of time looking at this in Los Angeles. I believe Color Change looked at this in New York. And one of the things that we found is that when you're talking about families, okay, in this context, right, if you're talking about family, the family context, there are news stories that then pivot to this issue of criminality and will bring up the issue of, well, there's African-American crime and it's rampant and that kind of thing. In a way, again, where that African-American criminality is being overrepresented when you compare it to crime reports. So it's kind of interesting to look at this context and see how even in this context of family, these stereotypical associations essentially get inserted into the conversation.
Interesting. And you did so. And just to tease that out, the theory being that one would imagine it's one thing. I mean, I'm not obviously not being forgiving on this, but it's one thing to have, in a general sense, a overrepresentation about criminality, let's say, or overrepresentation in regards to poverty, when you're talking about general topic stories or stories about criminality or stories about poverty. But to have stories that are about families and still have that dynamic there, that it's a, and I would imagine there's probably something that is analogous in the context of even of sports and entertainment as well on some level. But I guess that's for a different study. So the three areas in which you specifically looked were, I should say, I guess the three different perspectives were economic well-being, as you said, the idea of criminality and how that is represented in the context of families, and also the stability of family units. Just walk us through that and give us a sense of on those three areas, just how over or how distorted the view of African-American families are in regards to those three different topics.
That's great. So there actually are four.
So we left.
That's okay. We left out one, and I didn't in my initial comments mention, you know, the difference, right? But essentially, and you can go to the report and look at the specific percentages. But what we do for each of these is we look at how often the representation occurs, and then we look at various baselines usually put out by the government to kind of see where how much over or under representation is occurring for each one. And what we find is that there's significant, and we also do, I don't want to get too technical here, but when we're doing sampling, there's confidence intervals and other kinds of things that we're doing to deal with sampling error. And I know that's, I'm sorry, I'm not trying to glaze people's eyes over with technical language, but I'm just trying to let you know that, you know, we're looking at that and trying to be very kind of sophisticated and precise with our analysis. But in each case, we find that when we look at poor, those who are depicted as poor, African-Americans are over-associated. When we look at welfare recipients, we see that African-Americans are overrepresented when you compare that to crime reports. But in addition to that, the one I wanted to mention that we haven't talked about yet, we talked about criminality too, the one that we haven't mentioned is black fatherhood. And one of the interesting things we did for this, I wanted to kind of highlight it, is that we did two things. One, we just looked at pictures of who was interacting with their kids, right? And so we looked at the rates of interaction between black fathers and white fathers and white mothers and black mothers, okay? And so when we looked at that,
interaction
we saw the
with,
same percentages.
I'm sorry, interaction with each other, with interaction
with
their
children.
With the children. Okay, okay.
With the children, I'm sorry. Just to be clear, I'm sorry about that.
No.
So yes, we looked at their interaction with children, right? So how often were black mothers and white mothers interacting with their kids? And also, how often were black fathers and white fathers interacting with their children? And what was really interesting is there's no real difference in terms of the representation of black mothers and white mothers with their interactions with their kids. But we did find, instead, that there were significant differences between black fathers and white fathers. In fact, it's like half as much, you know, there's a half percentage or 50% drop off, if you will, of the interaction between black fathers with their kids compared to white fathers with their kids. And this was pretty significant. In addition to that, we also found that pundits, and this is the other thing I was mentioning with regards to our earlier conversation, right, is that if you're talking, let's say, about, let's say the conversation is about police violence or something like that, we often found that pundits would then insert these issues of black father involvement, right, as an example. They would say, well, you know, yeah, there's these police shootings, and, you know, that's an important issue. However, the real issue is lack of black fathers in their community, right? That this is part of the real thing that we should be discussing. The black fathers abandon their kids and what have you, right? And so that also came up. And we know that this is a stereotype, unfounded stereotype. If you look at a recent CDC report, that work says that black fathers are just as involved, if not more involved with their kids than other racial groups, right? So that this is kind of a myth that's regularly pushed by the mass media.
I mean,
when you take those,
this is also, and
oh, I'm sorry.
And I have to say, like, maybe I am filling in some gaps here, but it seems to me, when I remember Barack Obama's program of Brother's Keeper, I think it was called, that there was an implication. I mean, we're always hearing, right, from maybe Barack Obama didn't say this, but I seem to recall it. It was a couple of years ago now. But I also seem to recall, like, other sort of black media figures, particularly entertainers. I can't remember off the top of my head, but this, I have this notion of this refrain, you know, sort of saying, like, you know, black men, you know, it's important to be good dads and stay with your kids, which enhances and sort of builds this perception that, like, oh, black men must be leaving their kids in droves, because you never hear Woody Harrelson come out and say, you know, white dads, you got to be good with, you know, you got to stay with your dad, your kids, right? You know, I mean, I never hear that.
Well, I think one of the things, and this is really important, Sam, I'm really glad you raised that. One of the most important things for the news media to do is to provide data, to provide context for all of the different kinds of things that are being raised, right? And that's one of the things that's often missing. People will throw out assertions. Sometimes the people that are being brought on some of the shows are not experts, and they're just kind of being on there as pundits and representing themselves as if they are experts when they're not truly knowledgeable. And then they throw out ideas without context, without facts. There are pressures on the African-American community. And this is one of the important things I should mention, because I've had conversations with others about this. You know, there is a disproportionate – so there's a difference between disproportionate – and representation that we kind of have to lay out, right? So
right.
There are disproportionate poverty rates in the African-American community. There are disproportionate involvement with crime in the African-American community, which is largely explained, by the way, by poverty constraints and other contextual factors. There are other kinds of contextual things that are going on, and there are different kinds of family structures and living conditions and other things that exist across different racial groups, across different dynamics that are also out there, okay, that we should also discuss. However, when we talk about involvement, taking your kids to school, doing homework with your kids, having meals with your kids, interacting with your kids, right? When we think about those actual activities that we want, like actual involvement, the time with your kids, that there's no difference in race on those issues. And sometimes people kind of conflate things or misuse stats or other things, or they sub in other kinds of information to say that means there's no involvement. And it's like, no, that doesn't necessarily mean that. And that's partly, you know, we all need to be educated on that, right? We all need to be aware of that. When there was a political scientist named Marty Gillens who did a lot of the early work on poverty and race.
Yes.
And one of the things that he used to talk about is how almost all Americans had a hard time with the actual stats of who's poor. And a lot of people overestimated some of these things, and sometimes even black people will overestimate these things when they're talking about other black people. So there's a lot of bad information out there, and I think we all need to get good information and get a little bit more sophisticated in how we think about these topics instead of relying on tropes and stereotypes.
And I should say that we're also, I mean, if I understand you correctly too, you could have a situation where in Massachusetts more people die in vehicular accidents than say Vermont but the amount that it's talked about would have you believe that everybody's dying in Massachusetts through vehicular accidents, as opposed to just the representation of what's going on there is disproportionate with the reality. And that's really the problem.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And so,
yes, exactly. That's exactly right. When you think about the poverty rate as an example, right? So
yeah, let's talk about the delta. I'm going to talk about that delta where sure. we are, where we have a perception of what percentage of people living in poverty are African American versus the reality. I mean, where it's portrayed.
About 27%. Sure. So about 27% of those living below the poverty line, based upon recent census reports, are African American, which makes them, by the way, disproportionately poor because, the country is maybe 12 to 14% African American.
Right.
But on the news, what you find is when we look at poor families, that African American families represent 59% of those families. So that is the misrepresentation, right? So more than half of all the families that we discuss as being poor are African American when we look at the news media, where they only compose about 27% of the poor, according to recent census records. And, similarly, you find that, black families represent about 60% of the welfare recipients in the news and opinion media, but they actually only make up about 42% of welfare recipients, according to recent reports. So again, these are all statistically significant overrepresentations of African Americans with regards to welfare and with regards to poverty. When it comes to the issue of crime, about 37% of those represented as criminals in the news. And again, so what happens here is you have the way we're looking at that is you have a family and a family member being described as a criminal suspect. That happens about 37% of the time in news and opinion media, but only 26% of those who are arrested or according to crime reports are African American. So again, that's another overrepresentation. One of the things that I wanted to, I've already talked about the fatherhood information,
right.
But one of the things I wanted to mention is once we looked at all four of those variables, talk about the stability a little bit here. We looked at those and we thought about in concert, like what were they saying about a family stability in terms of whether or not a family is contributing to social stability or social instability, if you will. And what we found was that white families were more likely to be kind of depicted or framed as contributing to social stability, kind of the social fabric of America, whereas African-American families were essentially being framed as contributing to social instability, right? That the black family was, quote-unquote, dysfunctional, was dissolving, was problematic, and it was leading to these other kind of social ills in wider society. And so that's another thing that we saw once we kind of culminated and looked across all four variables and other information in the newscast. That's what was kind of being communicated overall with regards to the depiction of black families.
So now, do you have the type of data of that you can break down? And I'm not sure which order to ask this question in. Because on one hand, I want to ask, well, why do you think this exists? But I also wonder if there is a distinctions in this data between the type of media, either in medium, if it's different in print, is it different in online, is it different in local television versus national television? I wonder if there's a difference from a geographic standpoint. There's a bunch of different ways. There seems to be a lot of different crosstabs here that you could look at. I wonder if there's a difference in politics. I would imagine,
right.
And maybe I'm wrong, but I would imagine that if I was to look at a sample of 50 stories from Breitbart, it's going to be different mm-hmm. than 50 stories from, say, I don't know, HuffPost, maybe. I mean, so
right.
Where are the important crosstabs? And then maybe in that context, you can take a stab at, like, why does this exist?
Sure. That's a really good question. there's a couple of different ways to think about it. So one of the things that we tried to do was we tried to look at national news media, local news media, and other kinds of outlets, right, the newspaper blogs, and we tried to see who is most likely to show up in terms of the distortion. And one of the things that we can say is there's definitely two answers to that question, right? So one answer is some of the usual suspects were there. More ideological media tended to promote these stereotypes and these tropes quite a little bit more often than mainstream media. So you saw Breitbart rising to the top quite a bit, Fox News. But you also would see CNN up there as well, one that's not seen as quite as ideological as Fox, if you will. You would also occasionally see some mainstream news sources such as New York Times and ABC News and others as well. So occasionally you'll see reporters that are also part of the mainstream press relying on the kind of regular stereotypical thinking that we've been kind of trying to highlight here to promote stories or to run stories, what have you, right? That's part of what happens. And there's like a bunch of reasons why. So now let me tell you a little bit why we think it's happening. There's several reasons why, and I think if you read the report, there's some recommendations as well as some underlying critiques, if you will, of the media that perhaps will lead us to thinking more critically about where we go. But one of them is, and I've talked about this a little bit differently in my own research, but we talk about structural limitations and economic interests of the news media. That is that, you know, there are certain structural ways in which the news media is developed so that it's designed to make money, and sometimes making money means that I rely on narratives that kind of connect with someone's stereotypical thinking, you know, right. And that are easy to tell and quick to tell. For instance, as an example of this, in my prior work, I've talked a lot about the difference between blue-collar and white-collar crime. Well, white-collar crimes are covered in the news, but not nearly as often as blue-collar crime. Why is that? Well, one of the reasons is blue-collar crime is really easy to understand. Someone came in and shot this person or assaulted this person and left, right? And it's like, okay, that's the story. And then you immediately, what do you do in this story context? Put yourself in the mindset of, oh, my God, what if I was the victim? What if I was a family member? What if I was whatever, right? Whereas white-collar crime requires a little bit more sophisticated knowledge of, like, banking or other kinds right. of processes that everybody's not familiar with. And then sometimes the people who are committing the white-collar crimes are powerful interests who might be advertisers. So can you really do that story, and should you really do that story? And it's a harder story to tell. And so that's part of the issue. There's also something called ethnic blame discourse, which basically says that when you have news people who are journalists, right, as well as the public, but people who are journalists begin to form a kind of a community, and that community is not very diverse, right? So
right.
Most of that community is white. And so when you begin to think about news stories, you begin to think about them in terms of explaining them in terms of the ethnic other, right? So who's responsible for terrorism? Those Muslim people. Who's responsible for our immigration problems? Those Latino people, that's the blame, right? Goes towards Latinos. Who's responsible for crime? It's those black people, right? And that kind of thinking and framing begins to find its way into the actual newscast over time.
Sure.
So one of the recommendations in the report is diversifying the newsrooms to try to buck against that tendency to have that ethnic blame discourse take hold, right? So that's another way it wishes happened. So and just to let you know, it's not like it's, you know, these things happen on a lot of times. Sometimes it's really purposeful, and I believe when we're thinking about the ideological media, it's definitely much more intentional.
Right.
When we're thinking about the mainstream media, sometimes it's just part of these norms that evolve that are kind of right below the thinking. We talk about unconscious bias sometimes in the literature and psychology and in communication, right, that we are so used to thinking about things in this way, we kind of my wife, who's also a professor, calls it TUIing. It's thinking under the influence, right? You just follow that course of action without critically pushing back and thinking, hey, a second, am I thinking critically enough about, like, what's really going on here, or am I just reporting the stereotypes and tropes that, you know, I've just kind of heard out there that, oh yeah, black people are poor and they're criminals. And
the lack of diversity in newsrooms allows that to happen. I mean, if you have a newsroom where there's no Muslims, it is the idea that Muslims are responsible for terrorism can take hold. If there are Muslim people in your newsroom, they're going to say, well, wait a second, I'm not a terrorist, so it's not really Muslim people. You're not really describing it properly. You need to get more specific, and that's
that's correct. That's correct, and that's part of now that you have to. You know, that's why I mentioned structural first. That's exactly true, Sam. The other side of that is you have to think about the structural part of that too, because there are these economic interests that are also driving those narratives, right? And you have the corporate media that are pushing. Like, I just want eyes on my story too, right? And so, yes, that can help. Definitely diversifying is part of it, but you also have to talk back to the media. So we often talk about media literacy, and one of the things that you can do is if you see those narratives being pushed and you're a viewer or a consumer, you can say, you know, and we have social media now where we can easily do this. We can say, that was a bogus story. That was so stereotypical. That was so problematic. I really don't like the way you cover X or Y. And also, you know, you can speak with your dollars, where you can either organize advertising boycotts or speak to advertisers, right? These are the ways in which you assert power, because the corporate interests are going to go to where they think, okay, are there eyeballs here? Can we get the profits by doing this? You know, that becomes what's really pushed, if you will. And those both of those things have to come together, the diversified newsroom and the economic interest, to make it in the interest of the corporate media to cover things in a more fair and balanced way.
Now, so Professor, so let me ask you this. Now, and this is out of the scope of this study, I think, but you cited Martin Gillens, who I think Gillens did some of the work on just how much some of these youths, particularly I think in terms of economic well-being, are held not just by white people but also black people, and that they also have a distorted notion of this because they consume the media too, and you know, nobody can have a 30,000 foot a view of the world unless that's, you know, sort of their job on some level. But what are the implications on people's perspectives? I mean, I think, you know, that may be self-evident to people when you see that the media in some ways probably reflects people's perspective on this, as well as creating this perspective. But what about in terms of policy implications as well? I mean, you know, I think Gillens was arguing, and I believe it was Gillens' work, that the perception of things like forms of welfare changed when the perceptions of who the recipients were.
That's exactly right.
Okay, so so bring that forward to us. What are the implications?
So the implications are huge, and especially where we stand today, post this tax bill. Okay, so and the president's already hinted at where he's going, and I think that the media is probably going to make this, unfortunately, easier for him than it should be. But basically, the Republicans are probably, if I read this correctly and some of the analysis, are going to go after social net programs like Medicare, Medicaid, and welfare, and other kinds of support programs, and they're going to probably try to racialize it. And what I mean by racialize it is, and they tried to do the same thing with Obamacare, by the way, right? This is one of the things that was pushed by Glenn Beck and others, right, that Obamacare was some sort of entitlement or welfare program or reparations program or what have you for black people, right, that was the way to kind of demonize it. And if you think about, like, the last year, of course, people realized after Obama's gone, this is actually my health care, and I think I kind of want to keep that, you know?
Right.
And some people were saying, I don't know why I hated it. You know, it's always funny that when I hear that, we're like, well, you hated it because it was framed to you as if it was this black man handing out free stuff to black people.
Right. It came with the Obama
phone. Mitt Romney.
It came with
that's exactly right. Exactly, the Obama phone, right? And by the way, Mitt Romney made some. I mean, you know, we act like, you know, Trump is the only person who does these things, right? I mean, Mitt Romney essentially said something like this at the NAACP convention during the 2012 election. So, you know, it was racialized in that way, and I think that essentially they're going to try to do the other things, with the same thing with the social network or social net programs as we move forward, and they're going to have to institute these extreme cuts to make up for the $1.5 trillion deficit hole that they've created with the tax cut. And, you know, the way in which you can get the public to say, yes, yes, get rid of that, cut that, is by saying, hey, that's just being abused by a bunch of lazy, and usually with welfare, it's been the lazy black people, right? And that's what Marty Gillen's work shows,
right,
that it's usually kind of identified as, these lazy black people are taking advantage of you and taking advantage of the American system, and therefore you need to cut their welfare. And that's what partly led that stereotypical association between blacks and laziness that was perpetuated by the news media coverage of poverty and welfare is what partly led to support for the Welfare Reform Act of 96, according to Marty Gillen's work. And I believe that the policy implication is, as we move forward, as the Republicans move towards cutting the social welfare network that we have, that essentially what they're going to do is use those same kinds of stereotypes provided by the media to do that. So that's right. The policy implication, right? And people won't
so
think
Donald
of it as,
Trump,
well, it's, wait, that's my social.
Right.
Right. Yeah, they won't think of it as them. They'll think of it as those people who don't deserve, and therefore, I mean, I've actually read some really interesting articles about this among, like, people in Appalachia and other places that strongly support Republicans and Donald Trump, and this idea that, you know, they're really, really struggling and they could really use the assistance, right? And at the same time, they still racialize the assistance and therefore say, well, no, I kind of want to cut, but I'm struggling, you know?
Right.
It's almost like this interesting conflict, but they continue to do it.
I need my Medicaid, but I don't want the welfare queens who are driving around in their Cadillacs and buying lobster
right.
with food stamps to get theirs. And, you know, I think
Trump mentioned somebody who had a big old house who was on welfare or something, living next to other people who were working. I think he did this recently. If I'm not mistaken, I mean, I may be mistaken. I think I read that somewhere.
I'd be curious
online.
To look so, at I mean, a survey you know, so, of what people, and maybe at this time, you know, we've grown out of it, but if you were to ask people, like, describe a welfare queen, what the surveys would look like in terms of what race that woman would have been. I mean,
of course, it would be a black woman,
right? Of course, and
it would continue to be a black woman,
right?
And that's the danger policy wise that we begin to think of our policy when through the stereotypical lens that's being invoked and reinforced by media coverage instead of a critical lens. So it's fine to be critical, you know, one way or the other, right, of the programs, but think about it more broadly in terms of how that program's benefiting or not benefiting the American people, the economy. You know, social welfare, you know, all the things that, you know, constitutionally it should be doing, right? We can ask those questions. Those are fine questions to ask as long as we're not looking at it through this kind of racialized, stereotypical lens that's being promoted by news and media imagery.
It's interesting because, you know, as you're saying this, I'm just thinking like, oh, we probably need more reporting on poverty, say. Just specifically, you know, so that people have a better sense of just exactly who are living in poverty. But as I say that, I think like that's the context in which you see white people who are discussed as living in poverty if the story starts with poverty. And the real problem seems to be that when the story starts with family, black people get projected as being poor or being criminal or being destabilized as opposed to that topic being the beginning. Does that make sense? We're going to do a story on a black family. Well, that means we're going to be talking about poverty and we're going to be talking about instability
as
opposed to we're going to be doing a story about poverty. Oh, now we have the opportunity to talk about white people because it's the topic that comes first rather than it being sort of like artificially incidental to the primary point of, I guess, entry there.
Right. And one of the things that, you know, I would recommend, and I think is in the report as well, is this idea that what can we ask of the news media? We can ask two things of the news media. One is that their writing and their reporting is proportionate to the reality. And two, that there's more context and facts that are used when reporting on these topics. right? Those are the two things. We need the context, and we need it. We need the accuracy as much as possible. That's what we should be asking as consumers, you know, and pushing the news media to do as consumers, because otherwise we won't get a clear picture of what's happening in our society.
Dr. Travis Dixon, the report is A Dangerous Distortion of Our Families. We will put a link to that over at The Color of Change. I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break in just a moment. I should tell you that we're more than halfway through now, December 21st. Astrologers did say this will be the worst day of 2017. Apparently, the sun will appear to pass in front of the constellation Capricorn just hours after Saturn does likewise. This will cause both of these orbs to line up for the first time since 1664.
These aren't the orbs that Trump was touching in Saudi Arabia.
I've touched the orbs, and I've lined them up. This is according to London astrologer Neil Spencer. He insists that starting something new on this day is ill-advised. Will have long-term consequences. So be forewarned. Maybe today we will not call for people to become a member of the Majority Report. Maybe we'll just wait until tomorrow.
I was planning to launch my Patreon blog today, but
really?
I should wait. Yeah.
I would maybe wait. Wait a second. Matt, did my machine not work? I don't know, Jamie. Maybe I would wait till tomorrow.
Just to be on the safe side.
It's a gridlock alert day because of the holiday traffic that's starting.
Is this astrology still?
Well, no, this is just one more example of what you could be facing.
I was going to say, that's
a
traffic report.
I'm not going to do anything today, man.
You know, well.
It's a bad astrology day.
Monish to na. Anyways.
Womp, womp, womp.
I guess that was only a... There's not enough Jews in this office to understand what
funny.
That is.
It's all right.
Jamie, you don't speak Hebrew, do you?
You're looking at.
Do you know what Manash Tana?
I know it's part of a blessing that you say on Passover.
Yeah, she doesn't get it.
Maybe.
Michael said, "I'm not going to do anything today," and I said in Hebrew, "Why is today any different than any other day?"
That you was could tell the type of joke with his schmucky little face he was making.
No. Patience will not be a priority, especially if we're told we have to do something by our superiors. Oh. And we may be perceived as insubordinate. Be ready to deal with the repercussions of that rebellion, comma, Michael, said Lunar Living Astrology website.
Well, I would just like to take this opportunity to say that I think you did a great job with the Dane interview. I don't think anybody could have done better with Travis Dixon. People have been trying to interview Travis Dixon like that for a very long time.
If you are in Newgrange in County Meath, Ireland, please be aware that the winter solstice will be taking place at 3:30 to 4 a.m. 15 Eastern Thursday. So, we missed it.
Yeah, totally right. Missed it. We bagged
there
it.
There you go. Very well, that's what happens. All right, folks. For those of you who are in a different time zone or perhaps are maybe in Australia, I think it's another day, become a member of the Majority Report. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, check out TMBS on iTunes or on our YouTube channel. Check out our new website. We're not quite in beta. We're in post-beta. We're in somewhere between beta and alpha. We're in the delta between alpha and beta. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. What else can I tell you? Tomorrow will be the last live show of 2017, unless, of course, something else happens. Are you doing a TMBS next week?
There's going to be a TMBS tomorrow night at 7, because there isn't going to be a live one next week because of the vacation.
Okay.
So last two live shows of the year.
We, of course, will have best of shows next week. So check those out. You will enjoy those.
You will.
In the event that some type of big news event happens. Like, I don't know, Mueller gets fired.
War on the Korean Peninsula.
War on the Korean Peninsula.
All right, let's not go that. I can totally be like, oh, Mueller got fired. I'm going to go take a hike. War on the Korean Peninsula will ruin my break. So let's
that will ruin
that
your break.
There.
All right, so that's why we won't do that. I don't know, maybe if Jared gets rolled up.
Let's go take a hike and smoke a spliff.
That might.
Now we're talking great news.
We will... We'll try and put something out. Maybe it'll be a YouTube live stream. Maybe it'll just be another live stream.
If Jared gets arrested, we could just put out a conference call of all of us laughing together. Like, hey, Jared got arrested. Everybody have a good vacation. Yeah.
It could also, it would also be a great excuse for me to sort of leave the festivities.
Oh, I see your angle. Like, yeah. Sorry, Jerry got arrested. I get to leave my family. Goodbye. Hello. I'm going off to Daddy's private newsroom.
Yeah.
And big news happens and he doesn't have to deal with anybody in the family.
Or it could even just be, there's a chance that Jared's about to get rolled up, so I've got to be standing by my computer.
Dude, you should have already canceled whatever family plans you had to begin with, because it's always a big if.
It's true. This could go down at any time.
You got a responsibility.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will play some fun clips, ladies and gentlemen, like Mitch McConnell talking about what is the biggest GOP accomplishment of the year.
Hat tip to Sam Cedar.
Right, exactly. It was the development of the moon going into Lake Michigan. It was...
He called you, boy.
Donald Trump quite convinced that he's killed Obamacare. We will talk about that. He is very excited about setting records all over things. And maybe we'll take a look at that doomsday bunker.
That was... Jesus.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Again, you can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. See you in the fun half.
garçon.